Chapter 1. Are you a bit fucked? Step 1. We admitted that we were powerless over our addiction, that our lives had become unmanageable. This is an invitation to change. This is complicated only in that most of us are quite divided. Usually part of us wants to change a negative and punishing behaviour, whereas another part wants to hold on to it. For me, recovery is a journey from lack of awareness to awareness. Let me tell you what I mean by using my own vanilla experience as a bog-standard drug addict and alcoholic. I always felt I was rather too clever for something like a program for living, certainly one that had any religious overtones. It's not that I thought religion was the opiate of the masses. If it was, I would have had some. I loved opium. It's that I thought it was dumb. Drab, dry, dumb, shouty, hysterical, dumb, small town, dumb, foreign, dumb. Take Christianity. Either it's so medieval and swathed in pageantry that it's droning and ridiculous, or they try and modernise it and make it cheesy. Bad guitars, jumpers and knowing sympathetic looks. No, thank you. I had two serendipitous licks. One, I was introduced to the 12 steps by a seriously committed atheist. And two, I was privately desperate. I was broken. I'd run out of ideas and juice and was only kept moving by inertia. I'd given up thinking about why I felt sad or different or hopeless. I just knew I did. And I left that knowledge parked to one side in my mind, unaddressed, ignored, rotting. Meanwhile, I drank and used drugs to keep me upright and functioning, to stop the sadness running over. If you had ever tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Hey, Russell, what's your plan?" I may have reflexively spouted some cockeyed optimism about waiting for my break or this time next year I'll be a somebody, but deep down, I knew I had no plan. I ask you now, do you have a plan? You don't have to answer me now. In fact, there's very little point in answering me at all, given that I'm not there, you're alone, listening to this. But can you, in what ought to be the sanctuary of your mind, say to yourself, "I have a plan. I know where I'm going." My way of coping with the quiet anxiety of uncertainty was to find distractions and pleasures. I was never still. I was seldom reflective. I sustained myself with distraction. Here is a clinically accepted breakdown of the cycle of addiction. If this model is reflective of the aspect of your life you'd like to change, it's likely that the 12-step model will too. Let's see. A 5-point guide to the cycle of addiction. 1. Pain. 2. Using an addictive agent like alcohol, food, sex, work, dependent relationships to soothe and distract. 3. Temporary anesthesia or distraction. 4. Consequences. 5. Shame and guilt leading to pain or low self-esteem. And off we go again. I'll tell you how this applies to me, and you can mentally keep track with its application to your problem, and don't let yourself off the hook if I seem crazier than you. That's my qualification for doing this, remember. I was in pain. As long as I can remember, I didn't feel good enough. Now I'm a little older, I think, what does that mean, good enough? Compared to what, when, where, how? But back then, in my gurgling and nervous childhood and rash and frenetic teens, I just felt inadequate, incomplete, not good enough, and it hurt. I looked out at the world as if from within an aquarium, and it felt lonely. I also had no technique for addressing that feeling, so I had to invent some. That is number 2 on the 5-point guide. I used an addictive agent. And in my earliest incarnation of addictive behaviour, I used the innocuous toxin, sugar, chocolate, food. I put stuff in my mouth and I felt better. What's wrong with that? Forgive me if I'm patronising you here. I want you to understand a few crucial points. I was managing my feelings through external means, and the object is not in itself bad. There's no point in demonising chocolate biscuits. They of themselves are not the problem. They won't of their own volition kick down your front door, shine a flashlight in your face as you sleep, drag you from your bed and jam themselves down your throat. the participation of your consciousness is a prerequisite. For some people, a chocolate biscuit is a harmless treat. For some, a wee drop of rum or a saucy nip of smack is a tonic. The heroin will ferry you to crisis more quickly than a chocolate penguin biscuit, but the key point is the function of this external agent in your life. Number three is a temporary numbing, the moment of grateful exhalation and relief post-biscuit, post-coital, post-gratifying text from the object of your obsession, post-whatever it is you're fixing on. Point four is consequences. What is the price paid? I used to feel awful as a kid after I'd snaffled my way through a week's worth of biscuits in one absent-minded sitting. I don't think there's a person alive who doesn't reproach themselves momentarily after an orgasm achieved in solitude. And after using drugs, when I was coming to the end of my sojourn into substance misuse, was the only time I could countenance quitting. And number five is pain, and we're back to the start of the cycle. As Eckhart Tolle says, addiction starts with pain and ends with pain. Here we can see that dissected. As the cycle of addiction goes round, it gathers momentum like an out-of-control carousel, like the spinning of my nauseous head when drunk. The legal age to drink in the UK is 18. By the time I was 19, medical professionals and the teachers at my college had identified I had a problem and were telling me I needed help. In retrospect, it was evident much earlier, in the way I ate, related to people, thought about myself and my sexuality. I wish I could have identified these patterns, this tendency, sooner, so I could have begun to apply the methods outlined in this program. For me, though, things had to get worse. I had to repeat this pattern for 10 years, with consequences increasing with each vertiginous whip. I didn't know there was another way. I was a kid, then I was an addict, and by the time the idea of working a program had reached me, which with substances means abstinence and with behavior and food means structure, I was 27, a heroin addict, and in serious trouble. Step one invites us to admit that we are using some external thing, a relationship, a drug, or a behavior, as the power that makes our life livable. It asks if this technique is making our life difficult. By admitting we are powerless over whatever it is, we are saying we need a new power, that this current source of power is more trouble than it's worth. I have made this admission many times, and I make it still each day. It began with the admission that I was powerless over drugs and alcohol. They were the most obvious and troublesome power sources that I was using. The unmanageability here meant the negative consequences in my life were stacking up, and importantly, once I start with drink and drugs, I don't know when or if I will stop. The very act of drinking or using sets me on a course that I am unable to reliably arrest. It is admittedly more subtle when applied to pornography and overeating, but it's still clear that I have to structure my thinking around these behaviours, and that the structure can't be based on compulsive behaviour. To return to my point about two minds, a divided self, my experience of that was as follows. When I first heard about the program and the idea of abstinence was explained, I thought, "Oh, fuck that," and a kind of low resonant thud of acceptance that abstinence would be my path. One of the many paradoxes of the spiritual life I encountered here lies in the trite maxim, one day at a time. As in, just try not to drink today. Try not to eat unhealthily today. And try not to act out sexually today. I knew they meant you can't ever drink again. No more chocolate. Ever. And you are now celibate. Your ballroom days are over, baby. And they do mean that. If you are a serious alcoholic, you cannot drink. If you have food issues, you will always need structure around eating. We have to accept it. Where the one day at a time homespun thanks Nan wisdom kicks in is with the rather zen and incontrovertible truth that life is experienced in the present. Beyond today, your projections of life are conceptual. You don't have to not drink for 20 years today. You don't have to give up white bread for all eternity right now. And if you do make it through today and wake up tomorrow, what does it really matter that you didn't act out yesterday? I mean, you're not accumulating tokens for punitive pleasure. This one day at a time cliche, when taken plainly, is no less profound than any be-in-the-moment Eastern wisdom I've since encountered. Today is all I have. Now that I'm 14 and a half years clean, one day at a time, I like to riff on this concept like I'm Charlie Parker or Foucault. When I feel like I want to act out sexually, I surrender it. I don't act out. Then the next day, or even an hour later, I think, imagine I'd done that. It would be over now anyway, and I'd have detonated my family. Step one means you can change. It means surveying the landscape of your life, your family relationships, your working life, your sexual behaviour, your eating, your use of your phone, drugs and alcohol, the way you spend money, and asking, am I happy with this? Is this how I want to live? If there is a behavioural problem that lurches out garishly, some glaringly obvious looming catastrophe that this surveillance reveals, then it is here that you can take step one. I am powerless over this, and my life has become unmanageable. This unmanageability concept is interesting too, and as well as the more obvious interpretation of chaos and disorder, there is a deeper, scarier meaning. The first aspect in my case was plainly observable: unpaid debts, hospital visits, jobs lost, relationships lost, friends holding up their hands and reversing out of my life. I was creating chaos. I had followed another well-known 12-step trope. First, my using was fun, then fun with problems, then just problems. The positive aspects of my character were becoming redundant. It didn't matter that I was bright or kind or talented. These traits were being diluted to the point of irrelevance by the seeping negativity of my addiction. The unmanageability, though, has a disturbing and, in my case, demonstrable clause. When I yield control to that part of myself, when I drink or use or say fuck it around any destructive behaviour, I don't know when I'll get my life back or what state it will be in when I do. The unmanageability at its heart means that there is a beast in me. It is in me still. I live in negotiation with a shadow side that has to be respected. There is a wound. I believe that this is more than a characteristic of addiction. I think it's part of being human, to carry a wound, a flaw, and again, paradoxically, it's only by accepting it that we can progress. I took step one when I admitted I was powerless over my addiction and that my life had become unmanageable. That I didn't have control, no matter what I said to myself and others, and that it was getting worse. I knew there was no way out, that I had fear and shame that I didn't want to face, that I hoped I would never have to, that I would be able, through my will, to bend the world into making me feel all right somehow. When I met Chip Summers, bloody ridiculous name I know, who ran the treatment centre where I got clean, he was the first 12-step person I spoke to. He never mentioned God or higher power. As I say, he's a hardcore atheist. He makes Richard Dawkins look like Uri Geller. He just told me straight, you are fucked. If you carry on using like you are, in 6 months' time, you'll be in prison, a lunatic asylum, or a grave. And whilst I was a little shocked, I knew he was right. You might not be addicted to crack and heroin as I was, and the above might seem comfortingly alien, so I should tell you, I've since worked step one many times with food. I am powerless over food. If I start eating chocolate, I don't know when I'll stop. With sex, if I make sex the panacea, the salve to this pain we discussed earlier, I will soon lose control of my sexual conduct and I'll end up in more pain. Or work, or my relationship. In fact, I now work this program and therefore this step in a 360-degree fashion. I have no power at all over people, places and things, and if I ever for a moment mistakenly believe that I do and act as if I do, pain is on its way. If there is something in your life that's causing you a problem and you're aware of it, I bet you've tried using will, crystals, hypnotism and pills to placate it. My suspicion is they haven't worked, and my experience is they never will. Oddly, counterintuitively, in our culture of individualism and self-centered valor, it is by surrendering that we can begin to succeed. It is by admitting that we have no power that we can begin the process of accessing all the power we will ever need. I've heard it said that we have the ism before we have the addiction. I now attest to the presence of a conflagratory condition that awaits the substance to ignite it. Now, with 14 and a half years drug and alcohol free, I cannot clearly say whether it was in sex or drugs that my addiction found its truest expression. Certainly drugs and alcohol have the power to decimate your life with greater efficiency, but my escalation through so-called recreational drugs to hard drugs was underscored by a uniform pain. Many of the associated problems that addiction evokes are caused by their criminal status and poverty. What doesn't change, regardless of the manner in which addiction is materialized or the economic conditions of the afflicted, is the presence of pain. Pain is a signal. It's some aspect of us that's beyond our somewhat narrow conception of self communicating. A pain in the leg means, don't put pressure on this leg. A pain in the mind means, change the way you live. With earlier manifestations of the same condition, the signals were not easy to read. The impulse that made me eat too much chocolate when I was a kid was the same impulse that led me to heroin addiction in a child-friendly, socially acceptable disguise. Or when I was watching too much TV, even then, as a little boy, I was using external resources to medicate because I felt uneasy inside. My personal circumstances may have contributed to this. My mum was ill a lot and I had a tense relationship with my stepdad, but these biographical details are less important than the sense I had that something was missing. When I was a kid, knelt in front of the TV in the post-school pre-mum home hinterland, I believed I had a solution to the problem of being me with every penguin biscuit I jammed into my gawping trap. The distraction of the taste, the ritual of unpeeling them like a Buffalo Bill victim, the scraping of the chalk brown custard guts, enough to occupy me, to fill me up. So the treat of a perfectly enjoyable chocolate biscuit sandwich wrapped in foil became an emotional necessity, a survival tool. Alone at home, they toppled like a row of calorific dominoes into the hungry void. I already had a sense of shame and solitude around this behaviour. There was already something other than the simple eating of biscuits at play. When through the storm of puberty I graduated to porn in those charming, sepia, stuck-together pages of yesteryear, it was, I know now, the same impulse that led me to the chapel of the Lavie for masturbatory distraction and temporary connection and relief. God help the trainee perverts of today as they stand Kleenex in hand on the brink of a Niagara of every conceivable kink accessible with any smart device they can cram into their clammy palms. Porn is a clear example of how our culture is feeding the disease of addiction. The natural impulse to have sex becomes a compulsion to masturbate. The attraction to connect is culturally translated by pornography into a numb and lonely staring strum at broken digital ghosts. The most physically creative thing we have reduced to a dumb shuffle that'd embarrass a monkey. Of course, if you'd told me at 14 that we were a decade away from a porn paradise, I would have toppled back in Damascene spasms at the prospect and scoffed at any pious talk of it being corrosive. Because I had no code for life, no awareness that what I was doing was problematic. In fact, porn, such as it was then, hedge-snatched, stained and shared rags, was the solution I'd discovered to the problem of being me. And it is a strong medicine. I wrote this book on a laptop. I'm 41 years old and the temptation to look at porn was still there. So how am I in that moment, the moment which all enlightened folk agree is the only moment we actually have, the present moment, going to avoid looking at porn? Here is the process. I recognize that I have looked at porn before, and I know what the results were then. It was distracting and numbing, which is good, but it didn't provide any real comfort. If I'm honest, I felt a bit worse. The 12 steps, along with the support of others who understand how I think and feel, whether that's the trivial urge to use porn or suicidal thoughts, are the only method I know for disrupting detrimental habits. As a side note, it's worth mentioning that this is not a moral argument. For example, if you love looking at porn and don't have a problem with it, then I have no opinion on that or advice to offer. In fact, if you're happy with your wanking or boozing or drug use or self-esteem or relationships or eating, you probably don't need this system. If there's not a problem, there's not a problem, as they say in 12-step organisations. For me, today, on this planet, I thankfully aspire to more than brief interludes of numbness through food, sex, and the acquisition of delightful tight trousers with unpronounceable names, particularly as I now know they are all ciphers, poor facsimiles of the thing I'm actually seeking. I know then that looking at porn won't make me feel any better, that to look at porn, even though I have this knowledge, would be a pointless retread of a well-worn path. But as with heroin, chocolate bars, or relationships with inappropriate partners, knowing it won't work has not stopped me indulging. As if I have a negative faith in a self-destructive doctrine that life cannot be better than it is now, that I don't deserve better, that I am worthless and dirty, so who cares what I do to cope? Once I topple, go active, decide to pursue my nominated object of addiction, I inwardly switch to a circuit of behaviour that is distinct from my better nature. The Jekyll and Hyde story is an apposite allegory, and most addicts identify with the radical transition that occurs once they are triggered. There's no point you, in this instance, in the role of the Victorian flower girl, pleading with Mr. Hyde not to ravage you and kick over your begonias, telling him that he'll regret it in the morning because Mr. Hyde doesn't give a fuck on a stick. Far safer to ask Dr. Jekyll to stop messing around with alchemy when he is clearly dangerously unqualified before he's taken that first drink. I don't know what he got his doctorate in. I bet it's one of those ones where the university just give him a mortarboard and a cape for turning up and giving a lecture. Once I go, I've gone. There have been many instances in my life where in the midst of some self-generated chaos, I've been granted the benefit of hindsight whilst the event is still unfolding. It often takes the form of a mental bird's eye view. I seem to float up out of me a yard or two above the carnage I've created and look down at other me, thinking, oh look, there I am. I'm actually persevering with this mayhem. It's almost certainly a terrible idea. Oh well, too late now. I might as well jump back in with him and finish this shit off. This is not diminished responsibility. I am responsible for all the things I've done. It's just I wasn't this me while I was doing them. My life is about preserving the conditions where it is less likely that I will quantum leap into the other guy. To overcome that troubling and cyclical mentality, I had to believe that my life could be better, whether that's better than a life as a drug addict 14 years ago, or better now today by not looking at pornography. The consequences of my addiction were more palpable and severe when I was using drugs. The pace of deterioration, too, was, in retrospect, worrying. Most days were tarnished with a volatile emotional episode, physical injury, conflict, arrest, humiliation or violence. I was very fortunate and will remain forever grateful that people intervened in my enthusiastic rush to the gutter. Here you will hear much that might make you think, I'm not as bad as him, or he's still a nutter. But the transformation I have experienced as the result of these steps is the important thing and is cause for great hope in anyone suffering from addiction. This idea of hope we shall explore in the next chapter. For now, let's summarize what we've discussed. Do you have a problem? Is there some activity, drinking, eating, spending money, gambling, watching porn, destructive relationships, promiscuity, in fact, any behavior that is impairing your ability to enjoy life and life can be enjoyable that you are engaging in and are struggling to stop? If the answer is no, well done, carry on. You should have plenty of time on your hands to help others less fortunate and generally serve the planet and its people. If you're not sure, take a moment. Sit quietly in a place where you won't be disturbed. Close your eyes. Move your attention to your breathing, the rhythm of the breath. Each inhalation a new beginning, each exhalation a new ending. Do you feel anxious, afraid, disturbed? Is your mind constantly shuffling through thoughts, restless? Is it difficult to sit and do nothing? Do you ever do this, or are you, as I was for many years, constantly involved in activity or distraction? What happens when you sit alone with your breath? Your breath that will one day cease. For me, it usually begins as an uneasy experience. Even now, after years of meditation, and by now I'm sure you'll have spotted that I'm trying to trick you into meditating, I have to practice stillness to be comfortable with it, to be comfortable being born again in each new moment. To see that there is no way into the kingdom of heaven except through I, through self, through the experience of thought, feeling, action, the constant witness. A common meditation is to envisage the moment before death, to accept that this place of consciousness in which we sit, that which we call I, is the place from which we will experience death. In your mind, gently, without pushing, repeat a word that comes to you. It could be flower, or peace, or West Ham. Ideally, a word that you associate with serenity or nothing at all. I mean, it won't be helpful to sit there inwardly repeating the word Hitler or fuck off. It's the wrong attitude. Be comfortable. Be relaxed. Release the tension from your face and shoulders, and after a while, ask yourself, the inner voice, the part of you that has always been there when you were a kid, when your heart was broken, every time you've ever felt unloved, alone or lost, this voice, this continuing perspective that is in fact the thing that lets you know that you are you, and not just some bundle of organs and limbs, the thing with which your memories are threaded together, the bulb which shines your aspirations onto the screen of knowing. Ask this thing, am I serving you? Am I happy? Do I have a problem? If the answer is yes, then proceed. Before you start, you're going to like working this program a lot. I'll tell you why. It's made for you, by you, using a formula that will not exclude or undermine any of your current beliefs. Step 1, exercises. Are you a bit fucked? Here are some questions to ask yourself. They're a good way of getting clarity around your condition, addiction, call it what you will. Hey, it's only language, man. What do I want to change? Is it drinking? Is it being unable to put my phone down for an hour? Is it self-harm? Is it going out with inappropriate men? Is it thinking negative thoughts about myself? Is it lying? Heroin? Come on, how many examples do you need? I can't do this for you, you know. What pain or fear do I associate with change in this area? I won't fit in. There will be no joy in life. I won't cope without it. People won't like me. What is it? What pleasure am I getting out of not changing? Cakes are delicious. Cutting myself relieves me. This activity takes me out of myself. What will it cost me if this doesn't change? My husband will leave. I'll go to prison. I'll get fat. I'll continue to be miserable. What are the benefits I could gain by having this changed? My relationship, health, work will improve. How has this problem placed my important relationships in jeopardy? Friends don't want to know me. My girlfriend feels used, not respected. Have I lost respect or reputation due to this problem? Come on, do you still need examples? Has this problem made my home life unhappy? This is obvious. Has this problem caused any type of illness? Again, just use common sense. Do I turn to the type of person that enables me to practice this behaviour or to companions who enable me? These questions really get under the skin, eh? What part of the problem do the people who care about me object to most? What type of abuse has happened to me and others due to this problem? Have I neglected my kids, nagged my husband too much, or slept with someone I shouldn't have? What have I done in the past to try to fix, control, or change this area of my life? Diets, setting targets, moving house, buying a new hat? What are the feelings, emotions, and conditions I have tried to alter or control with this problem? Sadness, loneliness, fear, work worries, unhappiness with partner. Right now, if this is such an important area in my life, why haven't I changed? Am I willing to do whatever it takes to have this changed, healed, or transformed? If the answer is yes, then write out, go on, get a pen and paper. What do you mean you're on a train? Just get on with it. I admit I am powerless over whatever you are working the steps on, and that my life in this area is unmanageable. I cannot, on my own, with my present understanding, consistently manage this problem.